From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Ray Kirstein. This week, you'll hear your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, with some highlights of past shows that are surprisingly as relevant today as when they first aired. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
Francis Washington kissed the feet of 12 inmates, including two women.
And the surprising comments by Pope Francis sending shockwaves through the Catholic Church.
Saying the church should stop obsessing about gays and abortion.
Pope Francis denounced what he called idolatry of money in big business.
A pope to lead the Roman Catholic Church in the 21st century. A reformer, a liberal, or a conservative?
In the few short months that Pope Francis has been the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, he has sent numerous signals that many have interpreted as portending significant change in the course of that church. Many others insist it's all business as usual. What is inarguably true is that earth-shaking, revolutionary change in the church has come from the top before. And last year, Welton Gaddy spoke to the author of a biography of Pope John XXIII, who convened the Second Vatican Council, Greg Tobin. The book is titled The Good Pope: The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of the Church. With so much discussion of the current pope's potential for instigating fundamental change, and Greg Tobin's book set to be released in paperback this Tuesday, this seemed like the perfect time to revisit this conversation, which we will do later on this week's show.
We see more and more of people's religious freedom being crushed by the homosexualist juggernaut. Religious liberty and counterfeit same-sex marriage cannot coexist.
They want special rights, but they stifle the rights of Christians.
You've got the Obama regime trying to tell companies like Hobby Lobby, you no longer have the freedom of religion.
There's a growing number of lawsuits that claim to defend religious liberty in this country. Under further examination, however, a large percentage of them is actually intended to protect bigotry, bias, and even discrimination under the cover of religious convictions. This fundamental redefinition of religious liberty is no accident, according to a comprehensive report published earlier this year by Political Research Associates titled Redefining Religious Liberty: The Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. It outlines the history and the motivations behind this effort, and we'll revisit a conversation with the author, Jay Michelson, later on this week's show. But first,
the time for bickering is over. The time for games has passed. Now is the season for action. Now is when we must bring the best ideas of both parties together and show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on health care.
It was way back in September of 2009 that Barack Obama gave an impassioned speech in support of expanding access to health care and started the nation on this interminable road that is culminating with the act's implementation on October 1st. On Capitol Hill, opponents still refuse to give up, despite legislative, judicial, and even electoral affirmation of the law. What's remarkable is that today, 4 years later, an interview we aired in connection with this then-new initiative is as relevant as it was back then.
President Barack Obama addressed the country earlier this week with a much-awaited speech on health care. Here with me now to share his impressions is Rabbi Irwin Kula. Rabbi Kula is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. He is the 2008 award winner of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, and he is my friend. Rabbi Kula, welcome back to State of Belief.
Great to be here. Great to be here.
I want to talk about the president's speech in just a moment. But first, as someone who's written about messiness, you must have some thoughts on this mess that's going on in America lately. This healthcare debate has released a vitriol in certain parts of the American public that I'm not quite sure is even about health care. What are your thoughts on the climate in America leading up to the president's speech?
Look, I'm actually more of an optimist, I think, than most people. I think this is a, as the president said, this is a really serious issue. We have been trying to reform healthcare for 40, 50 years, and so there's a lot of heated feelings about it. And there are at least two very serious reasons for this. One is the political and economic structures are going to be rearranged because we're going to be affecting one-sixth of the total, you know, kind of power in this country. Mm-hmm. So I understand people defend their interests. And part of the greatness of America is that we go through these processes. They are difficult. People do get out of hand. It's a minority of people that really are getting out of hand, you know. And so it's not like we're having riots in the streets. We're not having a civil war. We have some town hall meetings in which some people are really out of hand. But this is not out of control. So one reason is real political and economic structures are going to be destabilized here for people. And I think what the president did is he got up and he said, look, no more lying. Not allowed to lie. Okay, we can have real disagreements, but you're not allowed to lie and create fear. And he said very clearly, this is a challenge to the character of the country. And character challenges, whether it's personal or countrywide, are very hard. I know when my character gets challenged, right, by my wife. I married 27 years last week, 2 weeks ago. And when my wife says, hey, you're not being such a nice guy, you know, and she challenges my character, it doesn't always bring out the best in me initially. So these are very serious issues, and therefore we have all this messiness.
I forget how badly I need to talk with you every once in a while and hear that optimism. But let me just do one follow-up on that, and then we'll get to the speech. Is there a level of incivility that we've seen in the town halls and that was even present in the form of one Republican congressman yelling out to the president, you lie? Were people able to hear the president's speech for what it was?
I think that's a great question. I think that most of Congress has already decided. And my sense is that Republicans, I don't believe these bad people, good people. These are interests, real serious interests.
And I think special interests.
Special
right?
interests.
Yes.
And I think Republicans have made a decision in general, one, that these interests are not to be undermined right now. And they also want to see the president defeated because they have a different view of how the society should run. I don't believe Republicans don't want people to have health care. McCain wants people to have health care. The worst Republicans want, the worst conservatives, they want people to have health care, but they really do have a different worldview. The worldview is that markets will, in the end, correct themselves such that people will get health care. And they don't believe in government getting involved in any significant way in this area. Now, this has been a long debate, and it's exactly what the president said the other night. It's exactly what he said. He said there has been, long-term in this country, a debate about the role of government. And the great moments in this country is when government did step in and engage in a major corrective. We forget, to get the civil rights legislation signed in this country took all the way from the beginnings of the country through a civil war, which was a lot messier than some crazy congressman yelling, you're a liar, who then is forced to apologize nationally within the hour. Okay.
So did the president make the case for health care reform that he needed to make?
I think his goal, it seemed to me, was to get Democrats, because I don't think he feels Republicans. I think they've given up on that. I think that he made a case to Democrats to say, listen, in the end, the character of this country will depend on this. And we know for the last 50 years we've been trying to do this. And it's we who have always made the big moves. We made the move in civil rights. And by the way, it cost Democrats for 25 years. South didn't vote Democratic. Mm-hmm. So there was a tremendous cost they paid for doing the civil rights. It was we who did Medicare. It was we who did Social Security. In the end, government has a role to play in lifting up those who are most vulnerable. We can do it responsibly.
Erwin, you are a respected rabbi. You are a religious leader in this country. What is the proper role for the faith community to play in this debate on health care?
I think this is a critical question. The one thing we can't do is everyone can't bring their scripture and their God to legitimate their public policy position. God is on all sides on this, or God's on no sides. And if we make God small, it turns out we have to have big guns. If we make God big, then we can have the conversation on the ground that we need to have. So no using scripture, no using God to legitimate individual public policy pieces. The role of religion and spirituality is to remind people that God is so big, that the reality is so infinite, that all of us are connected inside that, and there's a partial truth in every one of our voices. And then it's up to politicians and to people who are policy wonks and for people who want to delve into the particular policies to argue on the merits of that policy without bringing God into the picture.
Irwin, I have not heard it said any better. Rabbi Irwin Cooler is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. It's always good for you to be on State of Belief, and this was one of the best.
Thank you. I love being on the show. You know that. And I love you. You're one of my heroes, so just know that.
Walton Gatty will be back with more highlights of past interviews right after this break. We'll look at the power of a pope to fundamentally change the direction of the Catholic Church with Greg Tobin, author of The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint, and The Remaking of the Church. And up next, Jay Michelson, who authored the Political Research Associates report titled Redefining Religious Liberty, The Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. You're listening to State of Belief Radio.
Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Walton Gatty. Rarely does a week go by on this show that we don't talk about some manifestation of religion's encroaching on our secular society. As I take pains to explain on a regular basis, this doesn't come from a hatred of religion, but rather from a profound respect for religion. Something that is as important to countless Americans as their faith must not be corrupted and contaminated in the service of political or even cultural goals. And, just as importantly, the essential rights of Americans to worship or not worship as their consciences dictate must be protected. Now, if you ever doubted the relevance, urgency, and importance of keeping on this week after week and year after year, your doubts will evaporate after reading a shocking new report from Political Research Associates titled Redefining Religious Liberty, The Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. In it, author Jay Michelson lays bare the well-organized, well-funded, and alarmingly effective campaign to fundamentally redefine the meaning of religious liberty. Michelson presents case studies, facts, and figures, but just as important, he convincingly traces both the technique and the objective back through history and offers a future that would be unrecognizable to many of us who treasure the constitutional separation of church and state. Well, with that, I'm very pleased to welcome back to State of Belief Radio, Jay Michelson. Welcome, Jay.
Pleasure to be here, Wilton.
You and I were at the same conference dealing with the subject of redefining religious liberty here in Washington, D.C., I want you to start by telling us what happened. I mean, it was anything but quiet and just cerebral. What happened?
Well, you know, I think that's right. And one reason that happens is folks tailor their message to who they think is in the audience. And I think at that conference, there were some folks from a relatively conservative point of view who really kind of tried to play softball with their own positions. and make them out to be much more reasonable than they actually are. And having just completed 6 months of research on this report that you mentioned, I just wasn't willing to let that happen. And so, you know, we were told that the biggest encroachments, the biggest issues around religious liberty are people who just want to speak their mind, you know, like the CEO of Chick-fil-A. But that's not true. You know, the folks who were at that conference from the Beckett Fund, they're representing another company called Hobby Lobby, which doesn't want to just speak its mind, but impose its view on all of its employees and deny them the right to have insurance coverage for their contraception. So, you know, I just wasn't willing to be spun in the way that the presenters wanted to spin it. And I think when they were confronted with some of their actual positions, the jig was up.
Yeah, truth. I mean, truth is a controversial thing. to be honest, it would be valuable to have you just read the entire paper here today, but time doesn't allow for that. So let me ask you just to summarize what you contend in this important report.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of folks, a lot of listeners, I'm sure, really value religious liberty as a central fundamental constitutional value. And as you said, that's true as much for people of faith as for anyone else. You know, the separation of church and state was meant to originally to protect the church, not the state, but to protect the church from the wilderness of the state. But that term has now become a code word, kind of like family values. Mm-hmm. And it's used, it's been turned from a shield into a sword. So religious liberty in the free exercise clause of the First Amendment is meant to be a shield. It's meant to protect your personal, individual free exercise of religion. And so many of us, I'm sure, you know, again, many listeners remember the Religious Freedom Restoration Act from a little while ago. I was actually working on the Hill for the person who drafted that law. That was meant, and it passed 97-0 in the Senate for a reason, because it was meant to protect minority religions and religious practitioners from having their religious practices restricted by the government. It's a shield. But now it's been used as a sword. Now religious liberty is being used by a small group of very conservative Catholic intellectuals and conservative evangelical political figures to impose one's own view on others and discriminate against other people. So, for example, I should be able, as a bully on a high school schoolyard, to quote-unquote express my disapproval of homosexuality in the form of bullying a gay teenager. Mm-hmm. Or in that case of Hobby Lobby, which I mentioned, I should be able, as the boss, to simply not cover any forms of health care, such as contraception, that I may deem to be objectionable. This is radically new. This is a change in how we understand religious liberty, and it's kind of playing the victim. It's a shift of who's really doing the discriminating, who's the victim, and who's the oppressor. Okay. I think most of us would say if there's a bully and a kid being bullied, that the kid being bullied is really the victim. But in this conservative religious liberty rhetoric, it's the bully who's the victim if they're not allowed to express their opinion. It's the wedding photographer who's the victim if she's not allowed to discriminate against gay couples or potentially against couples of a different faith or a different ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And that really is worrisome, because for many of us who have fought for religious liberty for decades, we're seeing the very term be co-opted right in front of our eyes.
Right.
There's more of Welton Gaddy's conversation with Jay Michelson, originally broadcast in March of this year, coming right up. And later in the show, a look at how one pope can change the direction of the entire Catholic Church, with Greg Tobin, author of the book, The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of the Church. You're listening to State of Belief Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Jay Michelson. Well, you go way beyond what I'm afraid many of us get caught up in oftentimes, the immediate political and social implications of individual attempts to redefine religious freedom. And you rightly discuss, the historical origins of this strategy and how it came to be so prevalent today. I think it's very important you talk about that.
Well, and this is an important part of our history that I think a lot of folks don't know. You know, there's a myth that the so-called Christian right, that the, you know, the political Christian right, came in response to Roe versus Wade and in response to the concern over abortion. But actually, as the historian Randall Balmer has written about in two books, the Christian right was born in response to a different case, the Bob Jones University case. And that was a conservative evangelical college that had a racist admissions policy, and then it was later a racist housing policy, kind of segregation, and later a racist dating policy that blacks and whites couldn't date one another. And the IRS took away Bob Jones University's tax exemption. Notice they didn't tell them to stop their policy. They didn't stop them from doing what they were doing, but they took away their tax exemption as a result of these extremely offensive and racist policies. Mm-hmm. And the university fought back, claiming religious liberty or religious freedom. The same argument that is now being used to fight against women's rights and to fight against gay rights was used to fight against civil rights in the 1970s and the early 1980s. And Bob Jones University is still, all this time later, 35 years later, still a rallying cry for folks on the evangelical right. They still believe that that case, which was decided eventually by the Supreme Court in 1983, that was wrongly decided, that Bob Jones should have still been able to go along with their tax exemption, even though they were violating public policy with that with those policies. So, you know, it's an old argument that's been repurposed into a new space. And that's happened. I'll just one last point on that. You know, the reason that Bob Jones University fled religious freedom in the 70s was they had already lost the moral battle about desegregation. This was one of the last bastions of segregation and institutionalized racism in that form. And today, we're seeing a very similar thing happen with regard to LGBT rights and LGBT equality. All of the data shows us that reasonable Americans, whether they're conflicted Christians or moderates or whatever their religious beliefs are overwhelmingly now in favor of same-sex marriage and of equal rights for LGBT Americans. And having lost that moral battle on the merits, they're now fighting the same political battle with this new language of religious liberty. Just like they did with segregation, they're now doing again when it comes to LGBT equality.
Jay, that is such a thoughtful and insightful review of a whole lot of history. And I couldn't help but think, as you were talking, several years ago, I became friends with, or maybe just an acquaintance with, a young man who was working with some of the grandfathers of the religious right, and he told me he was in the room when a conversation went on between these early leaders, and they said intentionally, it is time for us to embrace a strategy of convincing American conservatives that they are victims, and that they are living in a society in which they are persecuted against and which they're martyrs. Personally, it makes me sick at my stomach because it takes a word that has a great history, the word martyr, a word that has a great history and is filled with integrity for people who have stood up for the right things and been hurt by it. And for that to be used as a categorization of the people who are trying to take over this nation in the name of their particular religion makes me sick at my stomach.
It is absolutely sickening. You know, it was interesting at that conference that we were at just a few days ago. There were people there who were working for real religious liberty around the world. You know, numerically, just how many human beings are being persecuted for their religion. Christians are probably the most persecuted religion in the world. Mm-hmm. But really, real persecution. People are being put to death. Right. People are being discriminated against in countries around the world. And there are folks who are forging alliances with conservative Christian organizations and religious liberty advocates and really working on behalf of people who are really the victims of religious discrimination. And to see the same word, religious liberty, used here as a sword instead of a shield and as this rhetorical club to fight the culture war is incredibly disturbing, because actually religious liberty is in danger in many countries in the world, and it's this very cynical misuse of the same term to defend people whose lives are at stake as to defend people here who simply want to discriminate against other people.
That's exactly right. What majorities in the United States do you see identifying themselves as victims and trying to actually prostitute religious freedom under that kind of disguise?
Well, this has been the rhetoric's been going on for a while, that there's a notion there's a war on religion. Phyllis Schlafly wrote a book on the so-called war of religion. Our friend Donald Wildman wrote a book also calling the Obama administration, you know, fighting a war on religion. But you know what's disturbing is that it's not just those extremists anymore. At the vice presidential debate in November, Paul Ryan accused the Obama administration of waging a war against Catholic churches, Catholic hospitals, and Catholic charities. Mm-hmm. This was not just a fringe moment. You know, this was really one of the high watermarks of this religious liberty movement, that a candidate for a mainstream candidate for vice president parroted the rhetoric that has been defined by these activists in such a forum as a vice presidential debate. It was an incredibly disturbing moment. And, you know, I think to give another specific example of why this is so disturbing, it's one thing when you have someone kind of quoting the Bible in your face and shouting fundamentalist slogans. You kind of know where they stand. But religious liberty is a value we all share. It's a constitutional value. Stanford University recently accepted a multi-million-dollar grant from the Beckett Fund, which is an organization funded by conservative Catholic organizations, including the Knights of Columbus, to establish a Stanford Center for Religious Liberty on the campus of Stanford University. This is absolutely unprecedented, and it shows the degree to which this argument, this strategy, has succeeded in co-opting mainstream institutions. The vice presidential debate, Stanford University, you don't get much more mainstream than that. And you would never see, for example, Stanford University create a pro-life center to rescue the unborn or you know, some other traditional family values center. Mm-hmm. This strategy is working where other strategies have failed.
Tell our listeners how they can find this report so that the conversation and interest can go on and on off the air.
PoliticalResearch.org. That's the Political Research Associates website. The report's right there on the front page. So it's PoliticalResearch.org.
Jay Michelson is the author of the new report, Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. Jay Michelson holds a Ph.D. in Jewish thought from Hebrew University and a J.D. from Yale Law School. And he's the author of God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. If we were looking for just one thing to justify the existence of this radio program, this report would be a fine candidate. It's tragic, but you're not likely to hear a discussion of this issue anywhere else in the media. And, Jay, I thank you again for the contributions that you've made to this show and to the lives of our listeners.
Well, thank you, Wilton, and what you just said is why this show is so important. So thank you for the work that you're doing as well.
We've got to take one more break, and then you'll hear a conversation with Greg Tobin, author of the book The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of a Church, that originally aired in October of 2012. You're listening to State of Belief Radio.
Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Today, critics of the Roman Catholic Church are likely to call it out of touch with the modern world in which it functions, slow to react to crisis within, and unresponsive to some of the needs expressed by its own membership. It's ironic, then, that exactly 50 years ago, it was some of these same issues that contributed to a global upheaval in the church as Pope John XXIII convened the Second Vatican Council. Now, this three-year gathering had an ambitious agenda, and little remains in the rules and rituals of the church that were not affected in some way by Vatican II. Now, a new comprehensive biography of John XXIII has been released by HarperCollins Books, titled The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint, and The Remaking of the Church. And the author, Greg Tobin, joins me right now on State of Belief Radio. Greg, welcome.
Thanks, Father Gaddy. It's great to be here with you today.
What led Pope John XXIII to call this council?
It's really my belief that it was the Holy Spirit moving and inspiring this particular man successor of St. Peter at this particular time to do this.
Mm-hmm.
He had a history as a historian, as a pastor, as a diplomat. He had a great love for the church, great faith in the church. John the 23rd, as Angelo Roncalli, was a faithful priest and scholar who just was a deeply spiritual human being.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sort of the vessel, I think, to carry out this mandate or inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And he did it with alacrity and with a lightness. Yes, when he announced in the presence of several cardinals in January of 1959, literally their jaws dropped open, and he very calmly assured them and instructed them that this will happen. So he had that great confidence and great humility about him that really caused other people to respond in a way that had this profound impact on the entire church.
Greg, where was the urgency? Did he see one or two issues as being more urgent than others?
I believe he saw the issue of the church's role and position in the world as the primary issue,
mm-hmm.
that the church was in a defensive posture, that many of its sort of outward practices seemed to be outdated or not really reaching the people, faithful Catholics as well as people who might be attracted to become members of the church.
Mm-hmm.
So his idea of aggiornamento or updating was the theme with which he announced the council,
mm-hmm.
and it carried through the entire four sessions of the council, even after his passing in June of 63, after the first session.
How did the Second Vatican Council address those issues? I mean, people got to realize we're talking about 3,000 people. How do you process that? How do you facilitate that?
Yeah, it was a complicated process. But the bishops themselves, when they came together in October of 1962, had been presented with a lot of preparatory material, background information, agendas, and draft documents. And there were sort of competing forces within that group, the hierarchy, those based in Rome who were very traditional, who wanted the council to go in a certain way, that the bishops would read these documents, maybe have a few comments, and more or less approve them and move on. But some European bishops especially, and some from outside the continent of Europe, when they came to Rome, said, you know what, we don't want to do it that way. We want to have full and open discussions on issues such as liturgy, ecumenical relations with other Christian communities. And so they forced the council, and John the 23rd approved this, to stop, to redraft some of the documents and order the agenda so that there would be time, a little bit of air, if you will, let into the discussion, and they weren't just going to follow a pro forma mm-hmm. agenda. And that set the tone for the next sessions of the council as well, and they got a lot of work done during those four sessions over 3 years.
Well, it's been 50 years. It's hard to believe that. What do you see as some of the most significant changes that came out of that church council?
There are many, and there are two that I sort of highlight in my mind, at least. One, the liturgical reforms. Now we take it for granted, pretty much, that the Mass is celebrated in the local language and that the people are invited to participate in responses and prayers and singing and as ministers and helpers in the actual Mass itself. And that's mm-hmm. so different than it was prior to the 1960s. And it continues to be refined. For example, the new translation of the Roman Missal in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That affects what the prayers the priest says as well as many of the responses of the people.
Yeah.
That's a direct result of Vatican II.
Yeah.
Another is the church's relations with other Christian communities and with non-Christians, particularly with Jews. The very last document passed by the council and approved by Pope Paul VI was Nostra Aetate, which dealt with the church's relations with those who who were outside of the Christian community. And it was a major step forward and a major change in the attitude primarily of the Roman Catholic Church as regards brethren who are, you know, not of our Christian faith. Also, the dialogue among Christian faithful, Catholics, Protestants, Anglicans, and Orthodox, has been carried on for the past 50 years in a very serious way. Some progress has been made, depending on kind of where you're standing or, or sitting and listening to the dialogue or observing what the results are. But these communities are speaking to each other. Some people are very dedicated, very passionate about this particular aspect of relations between between and among Christians. And again, that's a very direct result of the Second Vatican Council.
Greg, what do you think Pope John 23rd would say about today's Catholic Church and its relationship with the world today?
I think he would be pleased with many aspects of the Church's relations and position in the world today. Through mass media, the Church is very visible. The teachings of the Church are very widely available, and I think he would see that as great progress. He began to see that, was very conscious of that in the early television age in the 50s and 60s, so a lot of progress has been made there. I think he would be saddened and disappointed at the state of religious communities around the world. Membership has declined so rapidly, especially among women religious, and there are now, especially in the United States, issues of that the Vatican is concerned about, and women religious are, you know, are in a difficult position right now, and I think that would trouble him, and he'd want to, you know, really want to bridge that gap. The decline in the numbers entering the priesthood would also be a grave disappointment to him. And, of course, some of the recent scandals and difficulties, I think, would really break his heart. My strong guess is that he would take a very visible, strong, yet humble position as the head of the Church in dealing with all of these things, with proclaiming the triumphs and the progress, and really dealing prayerfully with the some of the very grave difficulties that we've all witnessed in the past few years and continue to today.
Well, if I may just say, as someone from the Baptist tradition in the Free Church tradition, this was a great man, a beloved man, and we can't have him back, but I sure wish we had his spirit back in all of the various expressions of Christianity today. My guest is Greg Tobin, author of the new book, The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of the Church.
Greg Tobin's book, The Good Pope, The Making of a Saint and the Remaking of the Church, comes out in paperback on Tuesday, October 1st.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners just like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 800-856-0277. As always, we encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen too. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.